could possibly just have been circulating in Fairbanks or in Alaska for weeks and just was under the radar screen.
A case of swine flu is identified in Fairbanks. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 28th of May. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the struggle to feed hungry kids when school's out.
In the summertime, you have to find community partners to offer this. So it's been a much slower growth than the school lunch program.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
The state virology lab is confirming the first case of H1N1 swine flu in Alaska. The patient is a middle-aged Fairbanks woman who first displayed symptoms about 2 weeks ago. Health officials say the case is a sign the flu is circulating in the state. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
The Fairbanks woman's case was complicated by the fact that she has allergies. She first saw a healthcare provider last Thursday, long after her symptoms began. But her provider was suspicious of flu because she had a fever. Dr. Joe McLaughlin is the state epidemiologist. He says the rapid in-office flu test came back negative, which is not unusual in cases of swine flu.
The provider felt that since the patient had a fever, he would go ahead and obtain a culture as well. And so he swabbed the patient and sent that swab to the state virology lab in Fairbanks.
The woman is healthy now and vacationing in the Caribbean. Swine flu is infectious about 7 days after symptoms first begin. Dr. McLaughlin says the woman left for the trip a week ago, about the same time that contagious period would have been coming to an end. He says health officials are still trying to work out how she became infected.
The patient had no history of travel outside of the Fairbanks area prior to onset of illness. And the patient had no known contact with a person diagnosed with H1N1 swine flu.
Dr. McLaughlin says lately only about 14% of new patients with the flu have traveled to Mexico.
I guess I would have been less surprised had the patient had a travel history outside of Alaska. But the fact that this is our tourist season now, we've got a lot of people coming into Alaska, and Fairbanks is a destination for folks. And so it doesn't surprise me that much that the patient did not have a travel history or a history of known contact to an H1N1 case.
Alaska's first case of H1N1 swine flu confirmed what health officials have been saying all along, that it was not a matter of if, but when the virus would arrive in the state. Dr. Jay Butler is the state's chief medical officer. He says healthcare providers in Fairbanks or anywhere else in Alaska shouldn't change the way they practice.
It really shouldn't be special precautions. What actually identifying the case does is highlight that, just as we've been saying all along, this is a virus that will spread nationally, and because it tends to cause relatively mild illness, like the seasonal flu sometimes does, we have to be prepared for it because we won't identify every patient who has it.
The state virology lab has tested more than 500 samples since the first swine flu cases began appearing in the U.S. in late April. Alaska is the second to last state to identify H1N1 swine flu. Now only West Virginia has yet to report a case. The U.S. has now confirmed nearly 8,000 cases, but only 11 deaths. Dr. Butler says the big question now is whether or how the virus will change in the months ahead.
The worst case scenario that some have worried about is that in the 1918 pandemic, there actually was fairly mild influenza illness during May and even June of 1918. And then it seemed to go away, but then came back in the fall with a lot more severe illness. So far, all the analysis of this particular virus suggests that it's not changing. It doesn't seem to be becoming more virulent in any way.
Dr. Butler says the earliest a vaccine will be available is October or November. But he says if H1N1 swine flu cases remain mostly mild, it's unclear how much it will be used. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Preliminary flood damage estimates are starting to come in. State Department of Emergency Management spokesman Jeremy Zedek says a damage assessment team has run up a substantial tally in Eagle alone.
So far, the joint PDA team that visited Eagle documented about $4.9 million in public assistance damages, damages to things like roads, public buildings, utilities, public facilities that are critical for the community.
Zedek says that number does not include damage to private property, including 21 homes destroyed by flooding and ice in Eagle. He says more homes and millions of dollars of additional impacts will increase the damage tab as state and federal assessment teams work their way through flood-affected communities on the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers. The state will likely get federal help in covering expenses. Governor Sarah Palin requested a federal disaster declaration earlier this week. Diana Seifert with FEMA says a federal disaster declaration could cover 75% of public infrastructure repair and replacement, as well as individual losses.
Funds for temporary housing or for the repair of a house so that people can live in it. We can help people with some of the other costs, such as replacement of essential vehicles, furniture.
Seifert says total federal aid to an individual is capped at $30,300. She says if a federal disaster declaration is issued in coming weeks, people will have 60 days to apply for aid, but she urges them not to wait on repairs.
By and large, this is a reimbursement program. People can go ahead and start rebuilding right away. They need to save their receipts, take pictures of the damage, and these will be accepted, so they don't have to wait.
Seifert says low-interest disaster assistance loans are also available from the Small Business Administration. She says it could be 3 weeks before a determination on the governor's request for a federal disaster declaration is made. Cooler temperatures and higher humidity are expected to limit growth of the big wildfire near McGrath. State Fire Information Officer Andy Alexandro says west winds pushed flames east late yesterday. Alexandro says the broken snowshoe fire is now estimated at over 21,000 acres, but some of that can be attributed to more accurate GIS mapping.
Absolutely better mapping, and there was a fair amount of erratic fire behavior yesterday, so it's a combination of both items.
Alexandro says the flames are moving toward some grave sites, the historic remains of a fox farm and recreational cabins, but that the pace of the fire's progress is expected to be slow.
Still anticipating a cooling. We may see some moisture coming in. Forecast for tonight is a probability of precip at 20% and increasing to 40% tomorrow. There most likely will be minimal growth again.
Alexandra says about 200 firefighters are on scene to protect cabins and other resources in the flames' path. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, addressing Alaska's lack of suicide prevention services in rural communities.
In the villages, it's almost like you're out in the middle of the desert and nobody there to talk to, nobody that can understand, nobody that can help.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by GrantStation, now offering several webinars each month. More information at GrantStation.com. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
Voters could encounter a lot of people with petitions this year. They're looking for your signature to help place initiatives on next year's ballots. Lieutenant Governor Sean Parnell certified two proposals yesterday. One would increase the property tax exemption municipalities may allow with voter approval from $20,000 to $50,000. The other would make it a Class A felony for a public official to use his office for personal enrichment or for the enrichment of family members or other Business Associates. This initiative's principal sponsor is former legislator Ray Metcalf. He says current state law does not forbid a politician from funneling money to his business or his family or to campaign contributors unless there's a direct link similar to videos and audio recordings used in federal prosecution of legislators and lobbyists in recent years.
This would outlaw handing money to politicians and then asking them for favors. You could hand money to politicians because you thought they would bring good government or whatever reason you wanted, but you couldn't turn around and ask them for a favor. If you want to ask them for favors, you don't want to contribute to them before you do.
In reviewing the application, the Department of Law found the initiative vague and predicted its effect would likely be decided by the court. But Metcalf says the initiative is less vague than the federal honest services law that is used in corruption cases nationwide. A third initiative approved for gathering public signatures would impose a tax on natural gas reserves if leaseholders do not participate in a project that includes the 20 must-have elements required by the legislature for the license TransCanada now holds from the state. Those were approved as part of the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act, or AGIA, in 2007. Anchorage Democrat Harry Crawford is one of the sponsors of the initiative. He says gas leaseholders claim they are already meeting most of the state's requirements, but they fall short in such provisions as the local hire and debt financing elements.
Those must-haves are, you know, they were put in the AGIA process for a reason, and we certainly want any pipeline project to have those must-haves in it.
Crawford says the 3 cent per thousand cubic foot tax would come to between $600 and $700 million a year. One other initiative is pending a legal review and certification. It requires parental consent before a woman less than 18 years old can have an abortion. The proposal follows several bills that were introduced in this year's legislature but have not yet passed. It's not a big problem getting meals to kids during the school year, but delivering those meals in the summer can be a little trickier. Alaska ranks near the very bottom of the states when it comes to providing meals to kids during the summer. For every 100 children who get meals during the school year, only 7 get them during the summer months. This year, with a little help, the Summer Food Service Program hopes to change that. APRN's Susanna Caldwell has the story.
For breakfast, food bank executive Susanna Morgan had toast with goat cheese, and Girl Scout CEO Jane Strait had cold cereal and miso soup. Congressman Don Young had a spare rib. But for 8-year-old Donovan, it was
reading cobbler, not just peaches.
Peach cobbler, sausage, scrambled eggs, raisins, and milk, both chocolate and 2%, all were provided as part of the Summer Food Service Program. It held its kickoff today at the Mountain View Boys and Girls Club in Anchorage. Congressman Don Young was there. So was Senator Mark Begich. They wanted to encourage other communities around the state to participate. The program is funded by the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development. It provides meals and snacks to low-income children across the state. This summer, it is set to provide meals in 53 communities and hopefully feed 8,000 kids. This is the third year that the food bank has sponsored the program. It's one of 20 different organizations that help fund it. But Executive Director Susanna Morgan says that even though the food bank provides the food, keeping the programs going in rural communities once school's out is the hard part.
But in the summertime, you have to find community partners to offer this. So it's been a much slower growth than the school lunch program.
Part of that outreach has included the Girl Scouts. Girl Scout CEO Jane Strait says that every summer they hold day camps in villages across the state. As part of the camp, they serve lunch for girls and boys. But they aren't just trying to feed kids temporarily. They're trying to set up sustainable programs.
The idea, I guess, is kind of to showcase the summer food program and show how easy it is to do so that someone in the village can then decide to take it on and do it for the rest of the summer.
Last year was the first year the Girl Scouts participated in the program. Strait says that Emonic and St. Mary's were two villages that adopted the program after the camps. This summer, they're hoping for the same results in other rural communities. Some of the villages they want to visit include Hooper Bay, Scammon Bay, and Mountain Village. Congressman Young, a former schoolteacher in Fort Yukon, has seen the benefits of programs like this firsthand and understands the need across the state.
I'd like to say I started one of the first hot lunch programs in the state of Alaska in Fort Yukon because I found out that a lot of them weren't getting breakfast. So I decided to give them a little biscuits and powdered milk and honey and butter. Amazing what happens to the mind when they have something to eat. The kids will have a better nutritional capability to be better citizens.
But even with the rural struggles, for the kids at the Boys and Girls Club who benefit from the program, it's just about getting a tasty meal.
So is it a good breakfast? You say it's good?
Yeah, it's a good breakfast. It's good, really good.
Today was supposed to be tacos, but they changed the menu.
Yeah, that might be. Yeah, but it's actually, I think... Eggs and sausage are better than tacos, but I think...
Even if every once in a while they get a surprise. In Anchorage, I'm Susanna Caldwell.
Southeast tribal leaders will meet in Juneau next week to talk about suicide prevention. Tlingit Haida Central Council is sponsoring the symposium with funding from the state. President Bill Martin says the native suicide rate is up.
Well, we need to have support services. We need to have people that can recognize the signs of suicide. We need to be able to teach people to recognize that when somebody is depressed, because depression is really the overwhelming factor behind suicides in Alaska.
About 20 tribal government leaders will meet Monday and Tuesday at Juneau's Alaska Native Brotherhood Hall. They'll talk about the problem and how it affects Southeast communities. Then they'll begin discussing solutions. Martin serves on the state's Suicide Prevention Council. He says villages lack many of the resources needed to help, and he says local leaders need to be part of the planning.
It's confusing because there's no place to go. Nobody that they can understand who would... they can talk to that and understand what's going on. Where, like here in Juneau, at least there are clinics that they can go to and clinicians here that can help them. But in the villages, it's almost like you're out in the middle of the desert and nobody there to talk to, nobody that can understand, nobody that can help.
Martin says community education is part of the solution to lowering the suicide rate in Southeast.
People have no idea why they're feeling like this sometimes. And it gets worse. You mix alcohol in with it, and it just multiplies the depression. People get actually more depressed. And so we need to be able to get information like this out to the villagers and to the leaders so that we can work on some sort of programs.
A number of government, health, and social service agencies already provide suicide prevention training and counseling.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by EcoTrust, working to encourage economic development, healthy communities, and healthy salmon in the Copper River watershed. On the web at ecotrust.org/copper river. APRN brings news about Alaska to public radio every weekday. APRN, we cover the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
The Anchorage meeting of Alaska Intertribal Council members wrapped up today with resolutions that support two big premises. AITC Chairman Mike Williams says the first requests congressional action to vacate the U.S. Supreme Court ruling in the Venati decision. The 1998 ruling said Indian Country does not exist in Alaska. The decision took away full self-governance powers from tribes.
And that's restoring Indian Country back in Alaska. And we're going to be asking this resolution to be supported by our own tribal governments, by our own native corporations, both in regional and village corporations, and our nonprofits throughout the state of Alaska, and breathe life into this resolution that this body just made.
The second part of the AITC resolution looks to repeal Section 4B of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act that extinguished Aboriginal hunting and fishing rights.
We want to repeal that to regain the hunting and fishing rights that we've always had and are being eroded over the years by the state and federal government actions. So it's very clear that the tribal leadership and the corporate leadership that participated and nonprofits that participated really fully supported the issue of subsistence to our people.
Williams says ensuring subsistence rights for Alaska Natives would not impact other Alaskans negatively. He says it represents about 3% of the resource allocation, and the idea is to take only what is needed. Williams says copies of the resolution will be provided to all Alaska tribal leaders, Congress, and the National Congress of American Indians. Southeast Alaska's newest lawmaker says he's looking for regional solutions to local problems. Juneau Senator Dennis Egan says he'll work with his Southeast colleagues on energy, transportation, and other issues, though he may have some differences. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has the story.
Dennis Egan's hometown got a taste of tight energy twice in the past year or so. Avalanches cut the capital city off from its main hydropower plant, bringing high prices more common in rural parts of Southeast. So it's no surprise that one of Juneau's new senator's top regional issues is energy.
Southeast Energy has to be included when they talk about the bullet line. We have to talk about energy for the entire Southeast and the entire state, you know, not just the rail belt. And, you know, we have different kinds of energy. We have free, renewable energy.
Egan, one of the region's three senators, supports legislation authored by other Southeast lawmakers to bank funds for new power lines and hydro projects. He says he'll join the charge to expand the existing grid, which could eventually link the region's communities. That could bring cheap power to diesel-dependent villages and provide a backup for those already linked to hydro.
Once you get the project constructed, the energy is, you know, water. It's next to free and just repaying the cost of the construction of the hydroelectric facility. But you have to tie them in. I don't think individual projects will bear out on their own. I think they all have to be tied in together and explore this as a region.
Egan is the son of former governor and territorial legislator Bill Egan. He grew up in Juneau and remembers his mother, former First Lady Neva Egan, dedicating the ferry Malaspina. The Democrat has been getting up to date on the Alaska Marine Highway System's latest plans, but he still wants a road built out of Juneau, something his predecessor questioned.
Well, I'm absolutely pro-ferry, although I differ a little bit from Senator Elton. I am and have been forever a proponent of a road extension, but I think that the Alaska Marine Highway System has to be expanded.
Egan became Southeast's newest lawmaker about a month ago. The semi-retired broadcaster was appointed to the seat held by Kim Elton, who left earlier this year for a job with the Obama administration. He's not yet found out his committee assignments. Elton, a longtime Democratic lawmaker, served on the powerful Senate Finance Committee. He also chaired the Legislative Council, which handles business between sessions, and headed up his chamber's Education Committee.
Well, I would, you know, be thrilled to be able to represent Southeast Alaska in Senate Finance. Having another member on the Finance Committee from Southeast Alaska, or what the rest of the state calls rural Alaska, is a godsend.
Southeast's top Senate Finance member is Sitka Republican Bert Stedman, who co-chairs the panel. It's unclear how long Dennis Egan will be one of Southeast's three senators. His term runs out in 2010, and he hasn't said whether he'll run for the seat. But he says he's more than a placeholder and expects to be an active part of the region's legislative politics. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
This Saturday, the Anchorage Museum celebrates its ongoing expansion project with a day-long grand opening. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
This is not just a building, it's a symbol of a new day at the Anchorage Museum.
Standing outside the new entrance, Anchorage Museum spokeswoman Sarah Henning launched into statistics. The $106 million expansion includes an 80,000 square foot wing plus renovation of the previous building. The project is not completed, but enough is done for the museum to reopen and celebrate. From 9 a.m. until noon on Saturday, museum members can tour the finished portions. After that, the museum opens its doors to the general public.
From 1 until midnight, we will be opened for free to the public. We're going to have an expansive entertainment lineup, both Lore 48 acts and local acts.
Besides a chance to explore the new addition, there's a golden lure to Saturday's celebration, namely the opening of this summer's primary exhibit entitled Gold.
It's really a dazzling exhibit that explores the scientific, the historic, cultural, and financial significance of what is the world's most rare and highly prized metal.
The museum's deputy director, Susie Jones, pointed out gold nuggets, gold blocks, a gold-papered room, a history of the world's gold rushes, with a special emphasis on Alaska, and the artwork.
Earrings from Hellenic Greece from 400 to 200 BC. This very elegant and simple ram's head out of sheet gold came from Iran and dates to about 2500 BC. The case in the end here with sculptures of Buddha in it shows examples of gold work from Asia.
Gold artifacts of the Incas represent the Americas. Immediately adjacent stand two cases of golden coins, themselves works of art. Gold always attracts interest, but Museum Director James Henry points out that allure is particularly strong with this opening exhibit.
This is one of the top 10 shows in the world right now, the Gold Show. We have over 300 gold items in the exhibition. Before, it would have been very difficult for us to bring this show here because of all the things with security, climate control, lighting, and so on. This floor is designed to handle these traveling shows that have strict requirements.
Not everything shimmering is inside the new addition. Distinguishing the exterior are windows made in Germany, modified in China, and tested in Florida. Henning explains the ground-to-roof windows combine aesthetics and utility.
We had to create this special glass frame so that when we're exhibiting things that have a little more delicacy, maybe they have feathers or natural dyes, we need to be able to pull down shades in between those two glass panels to protect our art and objects from UV rays. The glass itself also has a protective UV ray coating.
Just inside and to the right of the new entrance lies the museum shop, and to the left, the Bob and Evangeline Atwood Alaska Resource Center. At the center, the public can access, but not check out, the museum's approximately 500,000 historic photographs and 10,000 books. Chief Curator Marilyn Knapp says there's also other material unique to the museum and its past exhibits.
We might be dealing with people in Russia or Germany or back east at the Smithsonian. You could go back and look and see how that exhibit came together. We have an archive for each exhibit that we do.
Sorry, that's all the time we have for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
It was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Want to break your tobacco addiction? Call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-888-842-QUIT. Register for free Quit Line counseling and nicotine replacement patches. The combined counseling and patches increase your chances of quitting for good. Trained quit coaches will help you set a quit date and send you information. Free quit services are available to all Alaskans. This message is from the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line, 1-888-842-7848.
The H1N1 swine flu has reached Alaska. There are simple ways to avoid catching or spreading this or any virus. Wash your hands often with soap and water, or use a waterless hand cleaner. Cough into your sleeve or into a tissue rather than your hands. Stay home if you're sick and contact your health care provider. More information is available on the state website at pandemicflu.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the state of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.